And stumbling your way up next on the stream of Free Radio Santa Cruz at freakradio.org, it's the Bathrop Spears Broadsides, the July 11th, 2021 edition. This particular show is going to be probably in bits and pieces because it's being scotch taped together at the very last minute, and it's more a series of documents than a really coherent narrative. But there are some important things happening. There was a decision in Chico several days ago by Judge Morrison. I think that's his name. Morrison's his first name. England is his last name. He granted a temporary restraining order to Chico homeless folks back in, I think it was March or April. I think it was April, actually. And a couple days ago, he decided the city was just, he didn't say they were acting in bad faith, but he rejected their entire rationale, or the excuse they were using. That's the better way of putting it. An airport as a sort of a tarmac of an airport as a so-called homeless shelter as their excuse for enforcing anti-homeless laws that they had passed. So I'm going to probably try to read a bit of that. And a bunch of older stuff from 2002, the city council election debate, where candidates went on a show together, 11 of the 12 city council candidates. Two of them, people I campaigned for and with, Thomas Levitt and Steve Argue, and three who I campaigned against, Cynthia Matthews, Mike Rotkin, and Tim Fitzmaurice. And we also have interviews that I did on Becky Johnson's Club Cruise show, which was airing at the time, with guests Michael Schmidt, who is an unlikely crusader for homeless rights, who had originally been the CEO of the Chamber of Commerce, and Richard Quigley, activist who is at the forefront in fighting for the right to not wear a helmet as a motorcyclist, and also against corruption in the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Department, where he actually drove out Mark Tracy. At least that's my thought, a former corrupt sheriff. And maybe some other stuff too, but it's going to be probably shorter than usual, and it's probably going to be going out later than usual, so we'll just see how it rolls and rumbles.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me nap. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you.
So let's begin with the Chico decision. In the case of Bobby Warren and others versus the city of Chico. And I'm just going to read my way through much of the decision because it's not that long. It's a few pages, but it's I thought it was very significant. The previous action by the court in granting a TRO, a temporary restraining order, this one is I'm not quite sure. It's the next level up, a preliminary injunction preceding a permanent injunction. Just where the issue comes up for a formal trial somewhere down the road. The main point, however, is to stop imminent harm that's going on. That was what happened here in Santa Cruz, and that is what's had happened in Chico as well. So, according to the local Chico newspaper, which I guess is the Enterprise Record, this ruling preserves the status quo between the parties, which mainly means, according to writer Sharon Martin, that the anti-camping ordinances passed by the city of Chico cannot be enforced, and it remains in force until a judgment is entered in the case or it's lifted by the judge. To preserve the status quo between the parties pending a resolution of the case on its merits, the 8 homeless plaintiffs are represented by the Legal Services of Northern California. They're seeking to stop anti-camping ordinances that they claim violate the Martin v. City of Boise ruling, which established anti-camping can't be enforced if the city doesn't provide enough shelter beds. According to the memorandum and court order document, the temporary outdoor shelter use at Chico Municipal Airport does not suffice as an adequate shelter. Under none of these definitions of shelter is the airport site a shelter. It is an asphalt tarmac with no roof and no walls, no water and no electricity, Englund wrote in his analysis. It is an open space with what amounts to a large umbrella for some shade. It affords no real cover or protection to anyone. So there's a picture of the so-called temporary camping site in the city of Chico next to the municipal airport, which opened Friday morning, I guess a week ago, using beeline shuttles 4 times a day to bring people to the site, made with lines graded on graded dirt for each person's property with one tent for shade and water, several portable restrooms and dumpsters. And there was an earlier article on this, which I'm reading from, in which the TRO, the temporary restraining order, was extended, and of course now it's been turned into a preliminary injunction. The plaintiff's lead attorney, that's the attorney for the homeless, Sarah Steinheimer, contended the airport site does not meet those requirements, citing the facilities on site, the accessibility to the site with bus services running during set hours, and the closest grocery store being nearly 4 miles away. And I think I actually talked about this in a prior show, but those were some of the issues. Steinheimer, the attorney, also said that the shelter's outdoors, but that's not a shelter that as required by Martin versus Boise, which has always been the point made by local attorney Anthony Prince, I should say, homeless union attorney, who's been all over the state pressing for different legal protection for homeless people in Sausalito, Sacramento, Marysville, and elsewhere. If they miss transit, Steinheimer continued in Chico, there's no way for them to call for transit. They do have a cell phone. There's no way to charge one to call for transportation. It's a hazard to anyone because of the heat. Most effective way to deal with that is air conditioning. Ambient heat is going to be the same whether it's downtown or at the airport. At 110 on the black asphalt, it does go up. There's no question of that. And the judge did kind of grill the Steinheimer by saying, look, there are people who aren't homeless who are indoors but don't have air conditioning. Are you asking the city of Chico to provide a greater benefit to those that are outside than those who are indoors? But apparently he thought better of it, or at least considering the entire nexus of conditions when the judge made his final decision. And the city attorney, Ewing, that's his name, or her name, I'm not sure what the gender is, argued that by providing water, toilets, shade, vehicle parking, security services, and fencing, the city had done more than enough to meet within the bounds of Martin versus Boising. Cooking is also prohibited, however, at the airport site, so I guess it's going to be cold bologna sandwiches, sort of like getting ready for jail time, maybe. Then, of course, the question was, does it comport with the Americans with Disabilities Act? And it says, Englund, or the city attorney, replied, for a person to have stated in their declaration, we have walkers, a wheelchair, and so forth, that's understood. I point out the primary location where the largest number of persons reside, or Comanche Creek or Tetchert Ponds, which are dirt trails. We've moved from an uneven surface and so forth. So they're supposedly doing better for the disabled than they were at the previous camp. Again, this is all the attempt of the city to enforce anti-camping laws. And that as a sort of a, I haven't gone deeply into their history there in the recent history, but it's a pretty noxious situation of the city's trying to avoid any kind of real shelter for homeless by simply getting rid of them all, by making it intolerable to be around with the threat of police harassment, property seizure, and so forth being a constant threat. And then England said, your shelters are somewhat unique. He's the judge. You have one shelter someone can stay at for 17 days, and then they're forced to leave for a period of 30 days, and they're automatically then made homeless for 30 more days before they can come back. Actually, it's for 30 days before they can come back. So I guess it's a sort of good, strengthening training for the hostile world outside. Sort of an initiation ceremony, humiliation ritual, saving money for the city, whatever you will. And then apparently the other shelter in Chico requires the person be subject to religious training, which would be well and good with what the particular congregation does, but under the Constitution you can't force someone into that in exchange for being able to sleep, which is always one point that's been made by people here in Santa Cruz for its supposed liberal policy of letting people sleep in parking lots of churches if the churches want you to up to three vehicles per parking lot, something that's been on the Santa Cruz books since 1995, but is not frequently used by the majority. Well, it isn't used at all by the majority of churches, but it's only used by a handful and not with any regularity, except for perhaps very few. And there have recently been some significant complaints. I can't judge of their validity, but I always sort of perk up my ears when I hear such things. They are being forwarded by people like Alicia Cool of the Homeless Union and Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, and perhaps more on that later. Getting back to Chico, an April 23rd hearing, which I think the original TRO got passed around there, the judge criticized the city's ordinances, such as the Sitlai Law and the updated City Parks Ordinance against camping, saying they seem to be circular, they're overbroad, and they make it so that no one can comply with any of the ordinances. And there's no more details in this story about that. So apparently the city has been trying to patch that up by saying that they will place a call to shelters, find out how many, if any, beds are available for that night. If a person resisted going to a location available, then police would issue a citation. That's what the city attorney Ewing said. But Englund, the judge, said he disagreed with that notion that a person can't be cited for simply being homeless and would violate Martin versus Boise. So that's an extension, really, of Martin versus Boise. It's also an attempt to use what we call the Pottinger Dodge. That's what I call it. Pottinger was the name of a case in Florida in the 90s where the judge down there, Sam Atkins, I believe his name was, ruled that homeless people could not be arrested for so-called life-sustaining misdemeanors, whether it's sleeping, camping, making a fire to stay warm, cooking, taking a crap where you've got no place else to go but where you have to go. And he set up some safe zones, or the city did, and what they ultimately did was they created this dodge, as I call it, whereby they would keep a couple of beds open and they would force people to move and to obey police orders whenever they made a demand by saying, we've got a bed for you if you don't want to, you know, move. And often what that means is you lose all your stuff because you can't bring your stuff into, you know, if you're camped somewhere, you probably have more than you can carry, and so they were able to get homeless people to move, although they would lose their stuff anyway, it sounds like. And that's what the dear Chico authorities apparently were trying to do as well. And England apparently kind of saw through that or didn't agree with it. The simple facts of living, breathing, lying down, that's where we have the issue, England said. And there's, I think, their local sort of Take Back Santa Cruz-style groups there, one called Chico First. Hope I'm not... it's a Facebook group. But I'm not sure, because I haven't really contacted the people who are running these groups or the other homeless advocates in Chico. My bad. But let's get back directly to the more recent TRO, I should say, preliminary injunction decision. And let's give the plaintiffs credit, people pushing this lawsuit. Bobby Warren, Andy Lambach, Jonathan Williams, Michael Samuelson, Tracy Miller, Tona Peterson, Carol Beth Thompson, and Krista Stevens, collectively plaintiffs, who are homeless individuals and seek injunctive and declaratory relief, preventing the defendants, City of Chico, City, and City of Chico Police Department, police, collectively defendants, from enforcing various ordinances that purportedly prevent them from sleeping, sitting, lying, resting, and simply existing in the City of Chico. They also seek to enjoin the unconstitutional destruction of their private property. And on Saturday, April 10th, plaintiffs filed a motion for a temporary restraining order, and the case was assigned to the court. Given that the plaintiffs were challenging enforcement actions set to begin the following morning, the court did issue a TRO to preserve the status quo until full briefing could be provided and a hearing could be had on whether a longer-term preliminary injunction should issue. Essentially, the court called a timeout, prohibiting defendants from taking any further action until it could receive briefing from both sides on the issues. So these are sort of this is the legal background for this decision. The court set a hearing on the motion for the injunction on April 23rd, which was about 2 weeks later. At that hearing, the parties agreed to extend the TRO so they could work together to reach an informal resolution of the plaintiff's claims. They couldn't reach an agreement, so the case came back to the court on July 2nd, and the TRO was continued until July 8th when the preliminary injunction was granted. Sounds a little bit like the Santa Cruz case, where Santa Cruz attorney Anthony, I should say city attorney Condotti, agreed to work with Anthony Prince, and Prince agreed to work with him, and then, according to Keith McHenry, they had one meeting, and the city kept delaying all future meetings, and so they didn't have any meetings, and the city, well, these Anthony Prince entered into an agreement with the city, first to move people to the benchlands, because he was concerned that the judges was going to lift the injunction once the COVID-19 thing had passed, unless there was, I don't know. It looks like submissive behavior to me, but from, I guess, Prince's point of view, it was the best approach. I didn't think so, and I didn't think it was properly vetted out to the people outside. But it was pushed more as a solution rather than from on high, or maybe from, you know, local activists Alicia Cool and Keith McHenry. I don't know. Anyway, people have survived in the benchlands, assuming they don't get broiled away by the heat as we hit the heat wave this weekend and in the days ahead. Not yet successfully getting much shade, at least for most of the benchlands. And they have gained three more months of tenancy there. And now, of course, I'm afraid there's a feeling of complacency that, you know, oh, the city isn't going to move on this because that's what I hear from Jeremy Leonard, although he doesn't really know. And he says he's going to keep us advised if there is anything. He's the city-paid guy who goes and does different kinds of services for people there, and also gets some criticism from Keith McHenry and the Homeless Union for occasionally blocking things from arriving there. At least that's what they say. So it's this interesting situation that bears some resemblance to that in Santa Cruz. Continuing with what happened in Chico, because it may be something we can learn from and apply here. And this, I think I've talked about this before. What is an injunction? An injunction is a preliminary injunction is an extraordinary and drastic remedy. The purpose is to preserve the status quo between the parties pending a resolution of the case on its merits. A person seeking a preliminary injunction, a plaintiff, must establish that, one, they are likely to succeed on the merits, two, that they're likely to suffer irreparable harm in the absence of that relief. 3, that the balance of equities tips in their favor, and that 4, the injunction is in the public interest. And so usually you have both sides arguing on each of these counts. And that was the case in Chico, and that was the case in Santa Cruz as well. So under a sliding scale approach, the Ninth Circuit, according to this decision, weighs the factors on a sliding scale so that there are serious questions going to the merits. That is, there is less than a likelihood of success on the merits. They can still issue the preliminary injunction as long as the balance of hardships tips sharply in the plaintiff's favor and the two other factors are satisfied. So they're looking at the various legal technicalities for granting the injunction, which is not terribly interesting. But more interesting is sort of the specifics of this, which actually I printed the entire decision online on a story, which you can find in Santa Cruz Indie Media at indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. And that is under the name The Chico Decision, Hope for the Homeless in Santa Cruz. And you can read the whole thing there. I may give you more, but right now I'm going to bed, and I will wake up in the morning and hopefully continue this netcast, and you'll be able to hear more of it.
Bank is empty, card is full, and no matter how hard I pull, the car don't move. Rent is due. I'm not sure what else to do. Get a job. Perhaps I should. Pulling shots or hauling wood. It's a bit too late right now for that. So in the meantime, here's my hat. 'Cause this world I can't afford. I'm throwing a party for my landlord. 'Cause this world I can't afford. I'm throwing a party for my landlord. My landlord is a company which takes away all my money, as well as that of half the town. They're slumlords. Great renown, the Randall Group, the Group of Randall. You can bet they don't need to panhandle. They own my building, they might own yours, along with all of your mold spores. 'Cause this world I can't afford. I'm throwing a party for my landlord. 'Cause this world I'm throwing a party for my landlord. 'Cause at that time, the rent is due. This is a red line for me, don't know about you. Everything else just comes to a halt when you get thrown out onto the asphalt. Call it funding from the crowd. Sounds so nice. Rhymes with cloud. Call it begging, I don't care. Long as Randall gets their share. 'Cause this world I can't afford. I'm throwing a party for my landlord. 'Cause this world I can't afford. I'm throwing a party for my landlord. I'm throwing a party for my landlord.
That was another one from David Rovick, so I've been playing a lot of in the last few shows. It's called Rent Party, and again, it's part of his Oregon Songs collection, which you can find. I think you can find it online. Maybe you have to support David with a little money. I've done that. I don't know. To me, it's certainly worth it, and it doesn't demand much. And I don't think he demands anything. He posts a lot of his stuff free.
So I'm hoping to follow what's going on in other cities and kind of have in the past in Sausalito, San Rafael. We discussed that with some activists up there in the last Bathrobes Pierre's Broadsides show. Stuff is happening in Pacifica as well. That's a little town just south of San Francisco and just north of us. I don't have a lot of new information about it. I'm still trying to get up-to-date info, which sometimes stuff is happening very quickly. So I noticed an article in the Mercury News from March of this year. A group of RV dwellers and civil rights activists sued the city of Pacifica this week. I think I actually mentioned this in a prior show, fighting for the right to park the wheeled homes on city streets. The plaintiffs, backed by the ACLU of Northern California, say a city ordinance that bans RVs and other oversized vehicles from parking on certain streets is unconstitutional because it unfairly punishes people for being poor and unable to afford fixed housing. A burgeoning fight echoes tensions that are mounting throughout the Bay Area's high rent prices and a pandemic shuttered economy, although less so now perhaps, force many people to move into RVs. Cities from Mountain View to Berkeley are struggling to manage, i.e. restrict or eliminate, the huge number of RVs, trailers, and converted vans and buses that now line their streets. I'm adding a few words to these stories, I think, to attempt to make a little truth in my broadcast, even if the story has it somewhat differently, or at least doesn't mention some of the things I'm adding. It's not just an issue in Pacifica. We're seeing a lot of communities grappling with a systematic problem, said attorney Shirley Gibson of the Legal Aid Society of San Mateo, who represents homeless RVs, or plaintiffs in this case. Pacifica's response to it was particularly dreadful. It passed in 2019, its ordinance bans RVs and other large vehicles from parking in certain places, including on streets less than 40 feet wide, near an intersection, or in spaces that encroach upon a bike lane. Lawyers for the plaintiffs say their clients started getting cited for violating the new rule in September of last year, with one receiving at least 27 tickets he cannot pay. A first violation is punishable by a $100 fine. More than three violations within a year could be grounds for a misdemeanor charge, a $1,000 fine, and jail time. After five or more unpaid tickets, a vehicle can be towed. The lawyers argue that enforcement of the ban has been scattershot, leaving residents to guess where they can and can't park. The city has not installed signs on every street where RV parking is banned. I think that was one of the ways Santa Barbara fought that ordinance a couple decades ago. And the attorneys allege their clients have been ticketed on streets where it appeared parking should have been allowed. They filed the suit in the federal court in the Northern District of California and plan to ask a judge to immediately grant an emergency injunction that would ban the city from enforcing the RV ban, or ban the ban, as some of us would say. The city has experienced a significant increase in the number of oversized vehicles, including motorhomes and trailers that are regularly or routinely parked in city streets for long periods of time for work, recreation, or habitation purposes, the ordinance says. These large vehicles can impede traffic and block a driver's line of sight, potentially causing a crash, according to the ordinance. My comment, of course, this is the Cynthia Matthews, to quote, in my view, a homeless hostel council member who's no longer on the council now, but who's in a way a guiding spirit in the Myers City Council here in Santa Cruz, looking for potential dangers to allow for the possibility, which then gives the police selective enforcement to go after anyone they want to, and also puts everyone in a state of jeopardy, and particularly perilous for people who, unlike most of us, who are, or many of us, who do not, who actually have a rent, or those of us who do, own fixed property, we got no place to live except in the vehicle, or to try to weather the streets and the criminalization net that happens there, plus, you know, the environment that may be difficult on the streets generally for other reasons. While the total number of homeless people not living in shelters or transitional housing grew by 40% in San Mateo County between 2017 and 2019, the number of people living in RVs more than doubled. Other areas are seeing an increase as well. I don't know what the increase is in Santa Cruz. I have heard positive things at the Huff meeting, which still happens every Thursday, by the way, at the picnic tables between the courthouse and the benchlands. You can come on down at 11 o'clock and whoop it up with us and hear what's going on from some people who are experiencing this stuff firsthand. But there has been a mention that barriers have been removed at Swanton Road, perhaps in the apprehension of Coastal Commission action, because the city's restrictions that are in the coastal zone, which include a lot of illegal signage and illegal blockage and illegal behavior generally, such as their passage of the, I guess it's a 2015 or 2016 nighttime vehicle ban, the famous Rochelle Noroyan fiasco. It's still on the books, it just isn't being enforced. I think they're waiting for the Coastal Commission to turn as wretchedly reactionary as our current city council is, and as seems to be happening all over the state in terms of at least behavior by city councils and other legislative agencies going after homeless people, moving them around both in RVs and evicting them, criminalizing them. It's the lifting of the COVID crisis, as some see it, in spite of the Delta variant, is happening as the pretext for this. I think the CDC has loosened its, I don't know if it's loosened the shelter-in-place stuff for homeless people yet, but it's certainly, I think it's loosened its mask requirements. So this gives reactionaries on these bodies the go-ahead and empowers vigilante homeless hostel groups here and elsewhere. As a sort of counterpoint to this, and as an excuse for ignoring Martin versus Boise, the cities around the state, and in Santa Cruz, let's use us as an example because we're really the only one we can address directly with direct action and real, perhaps ultimately effective, either legislative pressure or putting our bodies out there and defending the rights of people who need to be defended, lest we find our own rights disappearing, those of us who are housed. Association of Faith Communities has a so-called safe parking program, and I recently sent a letter to the boss of that program after not getting much of a response from Steve Plaich, month after month, although I finally did get a letter from him, and I thank him for that. But he's, I think, vying to be in a more authoritative position in the Association of Faith Communities parking program. He at least mentioned that the last time he came to a Huff meeting. A CopWatch person, possibly Abby Samuels, I believe, forwarded to us, or we were able to secure some concerns. I think she or that person posted online back in the spring some deficiencies of the Association of Faith Communities Safe Parking Program. Many vehicles have been given a lot of parking tickets and can't afford to register their car. Safe parking, either the AFC program or any church or business, under the current and the proposed, well, the current municipal code anti-camping law requires that kind of registration. Many vehicles are not in the best working condition, and the owners don't have the money to repair them, so they can't afford the emissions tests. Hence, they can't bring their cars up to the current registration. You know, we're not talking about vehicles that are driving long distances and that are being used for transporting and moving at high speeds on highways. We're talking about things that people live in because they have nowhere else to go. That's a real difference that is ignored under the current vehicle code, and is also somewhat ignored by city police and highway patrol and county sheriffs, perhaps less so under the COVID lockdown, but now not so much. Or anyway, the old normal, which I think many authorities want to revert to. The old bad normal is in danger of coming back, in my view. Many vehicles are not working well, and other nearby neighbors who live in their vehicles help them tow their car to another safe place when police begin to harass them. Safe parking requires the vehicle to be able to drive once the COVID limit tolerance period ends. Most safe parking places require you to leave early every morning. I don't know if this is so much true as perhaps it was for during the time this was written, which was many months ago. Vehicles are not allowed to leak fluids. Many of them do. You are required to, again, this requirement to leave may conflict with your job situation. I don't know, again, what the specific details of this are. I have sent this series of concerns, as I said, to the boss of this program. It's a fellow named John Showalter, I believe. Sorry for any mispronunciations, John. I wrote him, Huff has received inquiries from vehicular residents with concerns about AFC's safe parking program. In March, we forwarded a number of questions to Steve Plaich, which I attached. He recently replied, suggesting they were better directed to you, who are more likely to have accurate and specific information. There's also some recent concern from members of Food Not Bombs and the Santa Cruz Homeless Union about members who report being excluded unfairly from the program. And you can read about this on Facebook if you go to the Santa Cruz County Homeless Advocates and Santa Cruz County Food Not Bombs. If you can get through the kitty pictures and stories in other cities, which are both cute, some of them cute and some of them interesting, but I never make it all the way through the Facebook is really a trial for me. Can you clarify the situation? I continue in my letter to Showalter by detailing the appeal process for those denied either entry or evicted from the program, as well as giving some detailed reply to each of the questions raised in this attached list. It would also help to hear how many applicants have been removed and how many denied in the course of the program. I also include in the attachment concerns voiced by vehicular residents, which I was just reading to you, you listeners, for your consideration and reaction. I invite him to come to the Huff meeting, and we'll see if John responds. Hopefully he will. I, however, tend to be skeptical of that possibility, but who knows? Maybe he will. It would be good. And continuing the concerns that were raised about the program by people who interviewed folks in RVs, many cannot afford the gas to drive back and forth to the safe parking program. Safe parking providers ask for very private health insurance info of everyone in the vehicle. A lot of people feel it is an invasion of health privacy. Many providers require background checks, and many would fail background checks, since you get a lot of citations and criminalization often if you're poor and homeless in Santa Cruz and in other cities. Many people don't trust the system after being led to authorities to be lied to by authorities, police, and others, so they don't want to be a part of the system. And many things are not allowed in safe parking programs, which adults would be able to do in the privacy of their home, if not driving, as well as the issue of registering visitors who come in to see you in your vehicle. And the questions that I had that Huff asked, we asked him a Steve Plaich, but they're now going to John Showalter, is how much money is the Association of Faith Communities getting from the city, county, and other sources to fund the safe parking program? How many vehicles and or people in the parking program are currently being served? What is the maximum number of people that can be served according to their limits? Is there a waiting list? How long? Is the city requiring, and is the Association of Faith Communities requiring that vehicles be insured and registered, as has been claimed? I guess another question which isn't asked here that perhaps Showalter will pick up on is, are people required to leave it during the day? They used to have a sort of a gone by dawn feature to some programs, and I think that's still the case in Santa Barbara, along with a vehicular ban for parking for so-called oversized vehicles throughout the city, which is a sort of a double jeopardy kind of thing. Or let's say, damned if you do, damned if you don't, Hobson's choice. Does the AFC demand restriction on visitors to vehicles during the day or night? Is there any requirement that the vehicle move? This is the one I mentioned before. To what extent is the Association of Faith Communities providing funding to, A, pay for past citations to bring vehicles up to registration standards, B, pay for smogging requirements so vehicles can be used as makeshift housing, and C, pay for repairs so vehicles don't leak fluids and can actually be allowed in the safe parking program? I mean, if they're getting a big chunk of money, a significant amount of this should go to be helping the people actually make their vehicles worthy of being able to be placed in their program. How many of a barrier are any of these concerns to getting permission to park in the Association of Faith Communities program? And if I receive an answer, I'll likely be reading it in a future show. So I think to get a kind of a summary, I am going to try to reach Keith McHenry, who was on a Zoom call that was mentioned at the union meeting earlier this week, a couple days ago, actually. Union meets and has a public meeting, although officers are trying to press, I think, for an exclusionary policy to not allow certain other members of the public not into the meeting, notably Jeremy Leonard and maybe Brent Adams, and I don't know who else, maybe me. Who knows? I'm a member of the union, I think, if you ask some people, and others say I'm not, so it's an interesting issue. I'm certainly both supporter of the union and also a critic at the same time, so that puts me in a difficult position at times, or an uncertain one. But let's see if Keith has anything he wants to say about this issue. He's often quite forthcoming on these issues, and I do appreciate that when it happens, although in this situation, people tend to get secretive, I think, frankly, because of a top-down directive from attorney Anthony Prince, which I don't have any evidence for directly. In fact, that's denied by Keith. He says, well, actually, that issue has not actually come up. But well, let's see what he has to say about this issue, about what's going on in other cities, Pacifica, for one, with this injunction. There is a class action complaint made out by the ACLU and the Legal Aid Society of San Mateo County. But that was in March. What's happening now? And what's happening elsewhere? Maybe we can find out. But it looks like that's going to have to wait because Keith's phone inquiries are going to answering machine. And that's because I'm now doing the rest of this show early Sunday morning on the 11th. And perhaps we can catch it later. I mean, I can catch him later and get more details because apparently there's a wide variety of legal actions or sweeps going on. It's sometimes these things get merged together. Hopefully legal actions will stop the sweeps in San Diego, Los Angeles, and many other cities. And I'll continue to try to struggle with it and pass on the information that I get. Let's take a musical break. And this is a song called Bought and Sold. It's about Oregon state politics, so it's perhaps a little out of our shooting range, but it'd be nice to see some songs about Santa Cruz politics, which name names and specify the local crimes of these politicians who are resting on their laurels.
The Senate in Salem is controlled by Democrats. They can say what they want to, but I got the stats. The ones taking the most from the owning class are the ones progressives give a free pass, such as the governor, Kate Brown, bribed as soon as she came to town, such as Mark Haas and Brad Witt, two traitors to the people who should promptly quit because they've been corrupted by the dollar. Landlords have them by the collar. You don't have to be a scholar to see who's bought and sold. Like Betsy Johnson, Rod Monroe, we know just where they can go. These servants of the ruling class, these traitors can all kiss my ass, cause they've been corrupted by the dollar. Landlords have them by the collar. You don't have to be a scholar to see who's bought and sold. Such as Lee Bayer, Arnie Roblin, who smells just like a Republican, such as Clem and Catty McEwen. We see just what they are doing, cause they've been corrupted by the dollar. Landlords have them by the collar. You don't have to be a scholar to see who's bought and sold. They've been corrupted by the dollar. Landlords have them by the collar. You don't have to be a scholar to see who's bought and sold.
So on Friday, a couple days ago, there was a Santa Cruz Homeless Union meeting, and also a meeting of people with who are in the Benchlands camp about resistance, and also that included allied organizations who are looking for ways to respond if the city uses its typical approach of moving on homeless people and just evicting them from the space they're in without any alternatives, just telling them to go hide out somewhere else or get out of town. And I'll begin with an interview with a brief kind of clip with from Leanne, who's a resident of the Benchlands, a very optimistic resident.
You're late. It's the 9th, and I'm out here in the shade after apparently a rather hot day, and right before the Union of the Homeless meets. But I'm talking with a camp resident, activist here and there, RV dweller sometimes, and just general all around, who knows what, Leanne. Hello, Leanne.
Hi, how you guys doing? I'm so happy. It's so beautiful here. We have water. I dumped water on my head. I fill up my my cooler, and then I take a bucket and just dump water over my head and took a nice shower, and it felt so refreshing.
Like you dried off.
And I've dried off since then. Because
it's really hot out here. I hear about rapes in the camp, anything going on there?
Yeah, there were two girls. One is, he slaps her occasionally, and we heard one slap and put a stop to it, and then they shot a mortar at my tent. But that's all right.
How long ago?
This was 2 weeks ago.
Anything in the last week?
The last week, my girlfriend, she's been hired to be a bouncer all over town. She's 5'10", and is a professional baseball player. And so she stopped one guy from raping one of our girls and kicked him out of the camp and wouldn't even let him come back for a skateboard.
When was this?
This was about 5 days ago.
Was it... You are an observer, or this is second-hand information?
No, this is... I was there. Yeah, I heard it.
And what time of day or night was it?
It was at 11 o'clock at night when so-and-so was slapping so-and-so, and we told so-and-so to knock it off, and then he yelled at my friend homophobic slurs and all that kind of thing. And then a couple of days later, it looked like a mortar came from their camp because they're directly across from me, and they shot a mortar into my tent.
What about this rape thing?
The rape thing? Actually, I wasn't there. This is secondhand for the rape thing, because I heard the slap, but she told me about the rape thing, and it was right by the charging station.
So how frequent is that in the camp, let's say, in the last month?
Well, this is, I haven't heard ever since Janie was murdered. I haven't heard anything about any other
rapes. A little bit about Janie.
Well, Janie was in late-stage alcoholism. She was getting wet brain, and I guess somebody went into her tent and choked her and murdered her and raped her.
How long ago?
That was 4 months ago.
So nothing in the last month that you've heard of?
No, not so much. Just these two incidents within a week and a half period. Yeah.
That's reassuring, because I'd heard I think Jeremy Leonard was concerned about this, or maybe it was someone else. I don't know. Has the camp changed much in the last couple of weeks?
I think people are settling down. They're starting to thrive. People are starting to go to therapy and going to taking medication, people that I know, and some are going away to treatment. One girl I know went back to her family, and they're going to get her treatment. So I think that because just being allowed to be in one place and not be harassed constantly is causing much less acting out from mentally ill people, and people are starting to thrive and get jobs and stuff.
Sounds good. Has there been much organizing in the event that there's a move on the camp by the city?
No, there hasn't been anything. I think it's kind of all our position that we're going to be here for a while, and unless during rainy season they may have to move us back into the park or have someplace else for us, but, let's look at their pattern of behavior, you know.
Well, we didn't have to have some place for the people at Highway 1 and Highway 9.
Right.
Similarly with the Camp Paradise people.
Yeah.
Have you heard anything about Camp Paradise, by the way? And there was, I understand,
no, I have not.
Fire down there the last couple of days.
That's news to me. Thanks.
Me too. I don't know.
Yeah. So I think most everybody, like from Highway 1 and 9 and Harvey West, they came over here. And then we've got the armory, which to me is an infection vector. I don't think anybody should be in closed buildings together, especially since 80% of us haven't been vaccinated, and I'm real concerned about that. So I've been encouraging people to get vaccinated, and, you know.
Is that working?
Yes. I have given 5 people joints for getting vaccinated.
See, bribing the people, using dope as your carrot.
Yeah.
And who knows what is your stick.
And like 5 more just did it just because they told me, oh, you talked to me, and then I went and got vaccinated because you explained it to me. So, and they know that I'm educated, and, you know, I have a science background and everything. And so I think they trust an individual more than they do the media.
And what is your relation with this notorious, the friendly goat and Kevin?
Kevin from heaven and our goat farm. We have this wonderful, it's called Rancho Mascota, and it's pet therapy. We have a 2.5-month-old baby that we're still bottle feeding. He rescued all these 5 goats, and then he has one that's 2 years old. And he's Casper the Friendly Goat, and then he just got 3 3-month-old goats. And so they're all ambassadors for the camp. And we herd them down the path by the river to the warming center and create quite a stir on the path. People get smile and stop for pets, and we just, so I've become a goat herder.
Indeed. Anything you want to add before I return to the meeting, which looks like it may be starting at any moment?
No, I just, I think this is the process, and just trust the process.
And we've been talking with?
Leanne Sherwood.
Thank you, Leanne.
So now, due to time constraints, I'm going to simply pass on a audio that I made with the knowledge and I'm assuming consent of the folks who were there because it was visible and I announced it. And I also agreed to turn off the audio whenever people didn't want what they were saying recorded. And this is lasts for about 70 minutes, maybe a little longer, 80 minutes maybe. So if you want to sort of skip through this, if you're listening to this as an archive, feel free to do it. Although I think there's a lot of interesting information, and I think the dynamics of how groups who are struggling to work for homeless civil rights operate or try to operate is very important. I miss not being able to tell you, because again of time constraints, I'd have to go through it in real time to do this, who is saying what. You'll find people speaking: Brent Adams, Alicia Cool, Joy of the people for, of Love Boat and a number of other groups. And my apologies, Joy, for, I don't want to mangle your last name. DSI activists were there and then later had a meeting of their own, which I'm hoping to get permission to pass on. I will see if that's possible. But this is the best information I think I can give about statements both from campers and from people outside, people who are trying to help those outside, housed folks, activists, as to where things stand on a number of local issues. So here it is.